Welcome to the abbreviated After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. We only have 1 hour tonight, and I thought, oh, maybe I could have like 5 or 6 guests in here all promoting something. I have chosen instead to have my new friend, Christopher Burrow, in here. He's a poet, but more to the point, I may, since we do have a whole hour, ask him to recite a poem or two. He's here with his lovely wife, Stephanie Browning, a noted jazz singer. The two of them met at a place called the Gold Star Sardine Bar. But more to the point, Christopher is the director of operations of the American Writers Museum, and it is a new, to my mind, you know, I went to the Walnut Room, I've seen the windows at Fields, I've plowed through the crowds at Kindle Market. Mm-hmm. I think it's a new jewel in the loop necklace.
That's a very nice way to put it, a new jewel. We're half a block up from the Bean at Michigan and Lake, so we are, you know, trying to be part of that scene.
Well, one of the problems I've always thought, I mean, you've been open now about 2 years. If it was on the first floor of any building on Michigan Avenue,
yeah,
right, at, you know, between Randolph and Lake, it would be jammed to the gills. And I think, is that true, this whole location, location, location thing?
Well, that was very much a first thought when they were looking at spaces, was to get somewhere with street access. But then proximity to the other museums and Millennium Park was almost a bigger thing. So we do kind of like that hidden jewel aspect.
I like that too. And everyone I've sent there, as you know, ladies and gentlemen who read, who are not simply radio fans, but who know me from the Tribune, read a piece I did about... I don't know, a couple months ago, about my love affair with typewriters. And the show you have featuring typewriters is one of the most amazing exhibitions I have ever seen. I'm not being hyperbolic. I have ever seen at any museum in Chicago. You were not a huge typewriter aficionado when that show was announced.
Yeah, when even before I started working at the museum, I did not have any real contact with typewriters except of clearing out my grandma's house after she passed away. And she had an old typewriter in a case, and no one really wanted it. It was something that, like, okay, it's from, you know, so long ago, we don't really have a value for it. But then, being part of this museum, and when we first opened, we had 4 typewriters that we let people use.
Whose idea was that? Because I think it's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, our museum designer, Andy Amway from Amaze Design, based out of Boston, he had seen it in, I think he was in Texas and Austin or somewhere, where people were using typewriters to type kind of notes back and forth, almost like at a bar or a club,
sure,
or something like that. And he saw that, and he's like, wow, there's really some spark there, he saw with people. And so we had the exhibit for, we call it our story of the day, where people can actually use these vintage typewriters to bang out some ideas they have.
And that grew to 6 typewriters.
And now it's 8.
8 typewriters.
Yeah, I've got 1 electric, and then the rest are all manual. So
one of the funny things is about people discovering typewriters is someone I know, he said they were at their grandmother's house, and they found this box, and they opened the box, and the little girl who helped open the box said, oh, look, it's grandma's sewing machine. And there literally are people who have never seen typewriters, are there not?
There are very, very much. Every day we get people at the museum who have never seen a typewriter, only in the movies maybe. You know, they have some.
Yeah, if they watch His Girl Friday or something.
Something.
Even in old movies.
Well,
I guess all the President's Men.
In Hidden Figures, more recently, people had pointed out that they were using typewriters in there. You know, they're catching it now. It's like, ooh, I see that, and they hear the sound, and they're so evocative, you know, it's so...
How did you, and when we talked, and I was charmed by it, how did you start to get seduced by typewriters? I was, personally, I'll tell you, I was seduced by the sound of my father pounding away in the office of our house on 2 fingers. Then I became a newspaper man when there were still typewriters in the newsroom. So I'm hooked. I'm a junkie. But how did you first start to?
Well, honestly, working at the museum and seeing how they work, the engineering of them is really amazing. And because we let people use them who have no experience with typewriters, I've learned how to repair them because I have to do a lot of spot-on repairs, just something to get it working for the next visitors. And I've then done some pretty extensive repairs, but it's just by learning as I'm going, kind of.
So, how would you do it? I mean, that's one thing that technology is probably useful for, is a typewriter is broken and you can go to YouTube, maybe.
I have looked at some YouTube clips. There's actually a professor from Xavier University who has a book and a website that's very helpful. His name's Richard Polt, and he's got a great resource that you can go to and learn a lot about it. But there are a lot of YouTube videos out there. They're not exactly model and make specific, so you kind of have to get the idea and then kind of go at it. So, I just recently fixed a carriage tension cord on a 1926 Smith Corona. It's a blue one that I bought when my wife was out of town.
Stephanie Brownie, Christopher Burroughs' wife, is going to get on whenever she wants. You can butt in anytime you want, Darren. Say, that's a lie. You didn't do that. Where do you find these parts for old typewriters? I mean, are they available? Because I know people, after I wrote that story, people would write in and say, hey, I have a typewriter. First, they would say, hey, I have a typewriter. Does that guy at the museum want to buy it? And then I would shy, slough them off. But then I want, where do you get ribbon for it? I know you can get ribbon, but where do you find parts for those old typewriters?
Well, parts, that's the hard part, is finding parts for them. So I had a nice Royal portable typewriter from 1945 that someone at the museum, when they were using it, accidentally broke the S key. So they actually cracked the key, and it's a piece of metal that's maybe 12 inches long that fixes into the back, into the spring system, into the whole typewriter. Someone broke it, and to find a part for that, it would have to be like you find a specific model of that era and buy that machine to get the part.
Take it out.
But luckily, in Chicago, we have a group that does Poems While You Wait, where they type poems at events and things like that.
Sometimes on street corners.
Sometimes on street corners. And one of the group, Eric, he is a typewriter enthusiast, and he actually is like, I think I have an S key that might work for you. And he dropped it off at the museum, so I get this one, like, S looking part.
And so it's so great that you tied into your other life, one of your other lives, as a working published poet, and tied into your poetry pals who helped you out with this.
Well, and I actually just met him through the museum. We had him come for an event, and so they saw the typewriters, and we got to talking, and he knows a lot more and does a lot more repair than I had, especially at that point. So he then, I think I have something for you. So he dropped it off, and then I'm looking at this piece. I'm like, how the heck am I going to fix this and repair that? Because you have to take the whole shell off, kind of take a lot of the insides apart. Without really knowing how they all go back together. Well, so,
but the other thing about it, when you do that, and I can see why you got hooked, when you do that, you see what remarkable, to my mind, it'd be harder to build a typewriter than it would to build an airplane.
Yeah.
Frankly. Well, I'm not a scientist, but so I don't know. We got to take a commercial break. We're going to talk typewriters and jazz and the American Writers Museum, which you can find by going to AmericanWritersMuseum.org. It is a place, if you're coming down for Kindle Market and to go to the Walnut Room and to see the tree and to see the windows at Fields and to see the bean, which has really nothing to do with Christmas, as far as I'm concerned, you should go to the American Writers Museum. Every person, single person I've ever sent there, bumping into them on the street, has written back to me telling me it's an amazing place. I hope in 45 minutes we can tell you how amazing. First, I'll tell you this. Chicago knows best, right? Here, you two, I want you to hear the dumbest commercial in the history of radio. Ready? Why they would pay for this is beyond me. Chicago knows best, right? Hit up Facebook and tell Chicago's best TV where you like to eat. Watch Chicago's Best Sundays at 10 p.m. on WGN-TV. Your pick may be Chicago's Best. Thank you, Dan Long. Welcome back. I'm spending this entire hour, this December hour, with Christopher Burrow. He is the Director of Operations at the American Writers Museum, which you can find at AmericanWritersMuseum.org or at, what's the address?
We're at 180 North Michigan Avenue. 180
North Michigan, just off Lake Street, in the middle. You can barely get to the Kindle Market or to Marshall Fields or to State Street or to the Bean without going past 180 North Michigan on the second floor. And you will be, I think especially any adult would find more than enough to enjoy in there. But if you have kids, I have found that this typewriter exhibit that we're focusing on a little bit, it's an exhibition of the typewriters of some very, very famous authors, including the weirdest one, I have to tell you, we were talking off air, Jack London's typewriter.
It makes
almost no sense to me.
Yeah, that's our Tools of the Trade exhibit. So yeah. Luckily, we got connected with a collector named Steve Soboroff out of L.A., and we borrowed quite a few of his typewriters, Jack London's being one. And it's from 1902. It's a Columbia Barlock, and it's pre-QWERTY. It has two different keyboards, one for uppercase, one for lowercase.
And if you have a computer at home, you think you have a computer at home, go look at it, because
yeah, the keyboard layout, how the top row starts with Q, W, E, R, T, Y, QWERTY, and you're used to it if you text and your keyboard is laid out like that. It's the standard keyboard, but before it was introduced, keyboards were of a wide variety, and they were trying to develop efficiency to make those machines faster than people could write by hand. So they worked on different styles.
One of the things you're telling me, I guess I'd forgotten that is a 1902 typewriter of Jack London's, meaning that the book published in 1903, Call of the Wild, which I am currently in the midst of reading, was written on that very typewriter. So if you find, Christopher Burr, that typewriter is somehow missing over the next few weeks, come look on my desk in the Tribune Tower. You have Hugh Hefner's typewriter. There's so many that would almost appeal to anybody, written by Hefner not being an incredibly popular author now, but there's so many over the Hemingway's typewriter.
Hemingway, Truman Capote,
John Lennon,
Orson Welles.
That's a good one. It's the anniversary of John Lennon's death.
Too. Yeah, and it was John Lennon's typewriter kind of pre-Beatles days. It's an Imperial, so it's made in England. And it does not have a dollar sign. It's got a pound sign over the five. So it's a little fun to see. We also have Sandra Cisneros, which was loaned to us by the Mexican Museum of Fine Art. And she still uses a typewriter all the time for her poetry.
Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, Tennessee Williams.
Ray Bradbury. And I'm just going
Bradbury, yeah, that's a great one. He would type 120 words a minute, he claimed, on that old manual typewriter. So.
Well, he turned out a lot of copy, as they said. I mean, I've been reading a lot about Jack London, and Jack London was happy if he could do, 1,000 words a day. And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty good, Jack.
Yeah.
That's like probably two novels a year. That may not be as fast as, James Patterson or someone like that. I know you go down there and you watch people look at that exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see, Christopher Burrow?
I see a lot of kind of open mouths, agape, like just staring. One of the big things too is we have a Braille writer that was Helen Keller's, and that was on loan to us from the American Foundation for the Blind. And people just look at that machine and they don't understand how it works or anything. It was really neat. There is actually a YouTube video of Helen Keller using that machine, see her using it. And she wrote all her speeches on the Braille writer because she liked to edit herself. She did use a typewriter, though, for her letters.
You know, it occurs to me in this, idiotically fast-paced world where, people don't write as much as they do tweet, that there's always been something about typewriters as opposed to computer keyboards that is, I don't mean to sound like Jack London, but it's work. It is, you can hear it. It is the sound of work. Do you write your poetry by hand?
Ooh, that's a good question. I written by hand, like on legal pads, for a long time. Then when I've gotten into this typewriter enthusiasm. I use typewriters too as part of the process. It's just a different way of thinking. We're so used to editing on the fly that typing is...
Yeah, there's a more deliberate, I think, when you're typing, at least, you think at a different pace. I think when you're typing on a computer, you don't care about spelling, you don't care about this, because some godlike figure will fix your spelling or something.
Yeah, and you can go back and edit. And the first thing when we have field trips at the museum and they sit down at the typewriters, first thing the kids do after they type a couple times is, well, how do I do backspace? How can I delete it? It's like, no, you don't. You can't delete it. And that just changes. You can see their brain like all of a sudden click, like, huh, all right. So I'm going to be a little more deliberate in what I'm writing, what I'm thinking about. Like, it becomes, has a different value, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. And I think, and now that I'm hooked on Jack London, I'm thinking of this guy, and I want to see manuscripts and corrected manuscripts.
Well, and he had a line that was in the biography his daughter wrote about him, that if it wasn't for the typewriter, he would not be a famous writer because people wouldn't be able to read his longhand.
Isn't that interesting?
And that's what typing did. It really kind of...
Well, it also, the other thing typing did, and I guess I got this from the exhibit, and I wound up watching a couple very good documentaries. There's one called California Typewriter. Mm-hmm. I think Tom Hanks is a huge collector.
Yeah, he's a big collector.
Typewriters. Was that the typewriter, it didn't fully emancipate women, mm-hmm. but the wide use of the typewriter got women into the workplace in huge numbers.
Yeah, they were called typewriters. The women were called typewriters.
That is the jazz singer Stephanie Bryant chiming in, as I hoped you would over this. But that's something else that I love about the history of that machine.
And that's very true. And we mentioned the QWERTY keyboard. Part of that design was to stop keys from getting tangled up. But also the other part was the guy who came up with that was Christopher Latham Scholes from Wisconsin. And he came up with that design because he was selling his first machines to a school that trained transcriptionists to transcribe Morse code. So they would have to sometimes hover over a letter depending on the context and then pick it to type it out. So partly our QWERTY keyboard design was to help telegraph transcriptionists transcribe Morse code and be efficient with it. So...
Wow.
And now we still use it on our computer keyboards.
Christopher Burr is as knowledgeable about typewriters as anyone I currently know. What I need to know, Stephanie, before we take a break at the bottom of the hour, is when he came home and first started talking to you about the typewriters and his new passion for typewriters, did you get jealous?
I was enchanted by it. what drew me in was the way the children mm-hmm. engage in them, and that he is the voice of a generation of children are going to remember this guy and look back and say, remember that guy who showed us the typewriters at that? You remember things like that.
Absolutely.
And I do get thank you notes that say, thanks for teaching me about a typewriter or how to type.
Well, and there are just little stories. Like one, a teacher said, I've never seen him focus like
this. True.
I had no idea he was capable of working like this.
Oh, you do listen.
And then one where Christopher said this little girl had a story to type and she did four tries.
Oh.
Like she wanted to get it perfect.
Yeah.
And like the idea of these children engaging in language and passion and communication, and this is something that they're just missing in their lives.
Yeah, no kidding.
And he's there to encourage them and make sure they don't break
so
the typewriter.
How long is the exhibit? Is it? I know it's ongoing.
The tools of the trade exhibit with the famous authors' typewriters, that is only going to be there through June next year.
Okay.
So you got some time.
But I think
we've got
go now.
Yeah,
it's indoors too, and it's going to be cold this week. Go now. We got to take a break. We're going to keep talking to Christopher Burr about some of the other things going on at the American Writers Museum at 180 North Michigan on the second floor, and to his wife Stephanie Browning Burrow about how they met. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to After Hours. This entire hour devoted to Christopher Burrow, his lovely wife Stephanie Browning Burrow, and the American Writers Museum, where Christopher is the director of operations and a a just if you're lucky enough to meet him when you're over there, just ask him about anything there, typewriters and all the other things, because he's really passionate about it. How did you get that job?
I answered an ad, and it just worked out with my past experiences. I was in healthcare actually for a little over a decade before I got this job, and in that position, I was a manager of operations, but I had to do troubleshooting of machines that, you know, were part of a surgery center. So I sometimes got called in. I had to go into the middle of a OR suite to troubleshoot an anesthesia machine. So
I thought you were going to say this is like typewriters. You got called in and someone said, hey, my arm hurts. Take out this guy's appendix. Something's wrong with this guy's appendix.
Nowhere near the medical side.
When you obviously have a literary side, too. When did you start writing poetry?
I started writing poetry a little bit high school, but more in college. More in college when I switched from bio major to English major, and that's when I started sending stuff out, and I got published a little bit right out of college.
Did you have, and it's a tough thing. I mean, as they say, there's no money.
It's not a growth business, right? Yeah.
Well, as I said before, unless you're, you know, Rod McEwen of a generation ago or Billy Collins of this generation, who I really do like. I like Billy Collins as a poet. And I suppose Keats made a living doing whatever Keats did. Did you think of it as a career at all, Christopher?
Well, I knew it would always have to be that and teaching. So it was always going to be the writing of poetry was never going to be a moneymaker. So I did a lot of just other jobs that allowed me to, you know, pay the rent and still have time to write. So a lot of, you know, I was in a sports bar restaurant business in Lincoln Park for about 8 years.
Which one?
It was a place called Jack Sullivan's. It's no longer there, but it was part of a group of bars.
My whole life is filled with bars who are no longer there. I still owe that place $40. Where was Jack Sullivan's?
It was on Clybourne near Webster. So kind of before the Clybourne corridor is blown up the way
more
it is.
Lincoln Avenue kind of.
It was part of a group for the guys who own McGee's and Duffy's and different places like that, Durkin. So.
And then one night you walked into a place called the Gold Star Sardine Bar and your life changed forever.
That's very true. I had actually been teaching English as a foreign language over in South Korea, came back, and there was an article in the Tribune that had a review of this great singer there. And one thing living over in South Korea, I really missed live music. Growing up in Chicago, you're so used to being able to see anything on the weekend, genres of all kinds. So coming back in, I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to go see some music. So I went to a couple concerts with friends and then saw a review and planned to go see her. Met my friend in Old Town and he bailed on me. And I'm like, well, I've been halfway around the world. I'm going to go stop at this club and see a singer by myself. And that's when I first met her, and you know, we became friends a few months after that. And
well, you obviously fell in love hearing her sing.
Well, she's an amazingly talented singer, and I did really enjoy going to hear her. And she will tell the story of how I did not. I would turn away because
Stephanie, tell that story. It's charming.
Well, it was charming
in its way.
For anyone who
remembers,
for the majority of the world who has not been to the Gold Star Sardine Bar, it was a tiny, tiny place. That's why they called it the Sardine Bar, because it was packed in,
and
it was so retro. I could go on. There were cigarettes on the bar that you could smoke, and it was just another world from now. But into this little world came this giant, you know, blonde guy that there were just not many people who looked like Christopher who came into the Gold Star. And I met him, and his business card was in Korean. I was about to record my CD, and talking to a woman at the bar, and she said, oh, well, let me know when your CD comes out. And he said, well, here's my card, let me know. So then I looked at his card and I looked at him and I was like, huh, this is something.
Yeah, what are you, what are you, the Rockford Files? This is a fake business card.
Then I noticed that he was turning his back whenever I was singing, and I thought, like, well, so rude, you know, the audience is supposed to, I'm over here. And I asked him about it later, and he said, I can listen so much better when I'm not looking at you.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good answer. So it was,
years
we were friends for a long time, you know, before it was obvious that
And you still perform around town, do you not?
I do, not as much. I was the artist in residence at the Peninsula Hotel for a long time, the better part of a decade. And so, you know, I'm still, I love singing. I was just at Catch 35 last night with Eric Hochberg and Bradley Williams, also of Gold Star fame.
Sure.
And someone came up to us and says, "You guys remind me of the Gold Star." So it's still out there, that place haunts us all. Yes. It never really goes away.
Well, that's a charming, charming story. And you like his new job. I think his new job would, because he must come home every day with something. Why don't you tell me about the place? I love the place. They have, if you know nothing of Chicago writers, you will get these banners about all sorts of Chicago writers. You can get a real kind of, you know, sort of a Cliff's Notes version or an introduction to some of Chicago's most famous.
And if I can just explain real quick for folks listening, the American Writers Museum, we celebrate writing of all kinds. So it's not just like novel writing and short stories. We're also looking at
typewriters.
Yeah, or typewriters. We're also looking at, you know, lyricists and comedy writing and critical writing and cookbook writing and everything that's helped shape our culture and our society. So in our Chicago Writer Gallery, we, you know, celebrate, you know, Saul Bellow and also Mike Royko and also Del Close and different other big influences on our culture.
And the new show, the new thing that opened in November, the American Writer celebrates what it means to be an immigrant and refugee in American today. That could not be more topical.
Yeah, it's called My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. And we have 31 living writers who pretty much talk to you. They look in you in the eye and they answer questions that we had for an interview, but these are on 55-inch touchscreen TVs where it looks like the person is answering the question right to you. So it's very immersive, very interactive. And we have, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning authors in there like Viet Thong Nguyen and Leila Liami was just on the short list for the National Book Award, you know. But also we have Luis Perez from Los Lobos talking about songwriting. And we have Aro Kwan talking about her first book that's just come out.
You also have a pretty robust series of events with authors. All you need, again, go to the website, AmericanWritersMuseum.org. I'm not going to...
And also for this exhibit specifically, we have my-america.org, and it takes you right to this this new exhibit and what we have going on. And in fact, Tuesday night we have...
This
coming Tuesday we have a Polish-American author named Dominic... Pasega is going to be on, and he's actually being interviewed in conversation with Sarah Paretsky. So
Sarah
that's going to be a fun evening.
The lovely and prolific author of Sarah Paretsky, who re-energized, and after Agatha Christie died, then all of a sudden came Sarah Paretsky with her detective V.R. Warshawski, who re-energized and reinvented the female detective crime theory. Most of her books set in Chicago. She's a delightful, wonderful woman. Dominic Pasega's book is reviewed in Sunday's Chicago Sun-Times by Neil Steinberg. If you need more frame of reference, Dom's an old hand at this, and Neil's piece is quite funny, but very, very complimentary. That's a great get, because Sarah is a remarkable person. That should be a fun
evening. But along those lines, that's the kind of people we're bringing in to support this exhibit.
Yeah, but it's the kind of people, too. I mean, when you look at your schedule of upcoming authors, and I mean, when I was there, you had a party for the typewriters that featured, you know, Christy Hefner and this guy from L.A. who buys typewriters.
Steve Soboroff is the collector.
And Nora Brooks Blakely, who is the daughter of the Pulitzer Prize-winning poetess, and she wrote a novel, too, Gwendolyn Brooks. I don't know if I told you this story that night, but you know, I've known Nora for a while, and Gwendolyn was one of the first recipients of the so-called Chicago Literary Awards,
right?
Literary Hall of Fame. And Nora got up there and told this long story about how she loved her mother, and she sat at a typewriter, and But you could not call my mom between 1 and 2 o'clock under any circumstances. Nobody could call her. Because if you did, she would pick up the phone and the conversation would go like this. Hello? Mom, hi, it's Nora calling. I told you from 1 to 2 is all my children, and would smash the phone down. And I thought, if that doesn't, I mean, Gwendolyn Brooks was a great poet, Pulitzer Prize winning poet. If that doesn't humanize Gwendolyn Brooks, I just don't know what would. We got to take another little break, and then we're going to tell you more interesting stuff going on at the American Writers Museum. .org. You can, Christopher Burrow, the director of operations, told you to go. I recommend going there and slash whatever you said, immigrant something.
The direct site is my-america.org. That'll take you right to the current exhibit.
I still think it and spend the rest of your time exploring it all. It's a great website, too.
No, thanks.
And Stephanie Browning, we'll talk more about her music and her CD and the review by Howard Reich. I sit next to Howard Reich at the Tribune, and I'm going to go to tomorrow if he comes in and say, Howard, Howard, you're not going to believe this. You were a matchmaker. We'll be right back. Well, you have heard the story of Christopher and Stephanie's meeting. You have heard about Christopher Burrow's new love and fascination with typewriters and my ongoing fascination with typewriters. You've heard about a number of things going on at the American Writers Museum at 180 North Michigan. It should really be a holiday stop for you. You will be charmed beyond words. You can even type a Christmas message on the typewriter there.
Some of the kids now are typing letters to Santa.
Are they at the museum?
I thought, you know, I told them maybe Santa will give you a little more credit because he knows how hard it is to type.
Stephanie, you're right. He has influenced a generation of Chicago children. If someone happened to get a present that they wrote down, Santa, dear Santa, type, dear Santa, I want a new red wagon, and they get the red wagon, they're going to think you're God or something.
Or Santa.
It was kind of along these lines. There was a little boy that was in the couple days before Thanksgiving. He had actually taken the train in with his mom from Montana, and he has a Royal typewriter in the case. And he, I don't know, he's maybe like 10 or 11, and he wanted to ask me some typewriter questions.
Oh, my God.
He had to replace the ribbon, so we were talking about that and stuff. And then for the kids and the adults alike who are really into it, I can sometimes go upstairs and get my Oliver typewriter, which is a 1919 Batwing style typewriter.
I've seen that.
Yeah, I did drag you up to the office.
I ran up the stairs. I was lucky enough to do that. It just seems that you have found, if not your perfect job, that being having a collection of poetry ride the bestseller list, but the next the next best thing. You really,
this,
really...
This really does kind of fit in all of my skills that I've acquired over the half a century I've been alive.
You want to read us a poem?
Sure.
Stephanie, what do you think?
I think it's great. I'm so excited. Right.
I will. This one was published in Free Lunch, which was a journal based outside here, Chicago. It's called From Iowa. Winter here hangs like Grandpa's overcoat, so heavy you couldn't lift your arms. He wore that coat to church and the bank in Spencer twice a month. Grandpa was so handsome in that dark cloth, we buried him in it. Although we should have boxed him in his dirty bib overalls. God knows how he loved the farm, waiting till harvest to pass. Then he was braver than most men, watching his grave being dug one season at a time.
I love it. You don't have a collection, do you?
No, I don't. No,
if people Google Christopher Burrow poetry, will they find enough to satisfy them?
Well, honestly, this was done well before the internet. Okay. So not that they would maybe find some articles I had written within these Times magazine.
Are you still writing poetry?
I do. I still write poetry all the time. With now, I use my typewriter. I use pens, but also then I use my notes app, because then it's on my computer, my pad, and my phone all at the same time. So,
almost impossible to lose.
Well, but then I do take that and I go to the typewriter and I sit down and I hack at it with the typewriter a little bit, because like we were talking earlier, it's a different way of thinking.
So. Yeah, it really is a different way of thinking, and it's a different
and the sound and the
and it's also a different way of keeping it. Too. It is a different way of storing. I literally do not trust and never have my computer at work, which has most of my life on it, and I trust these old phone books that I have numbers written.
Nice.
And it's also, I mean, the revolution in music is a strange one too, isn't it, Stephanie, over the last...
Yeah, don't get me started. Yeah. That's a whole nother hour. But I want to say about the Writers' Museum, it's not like any other museum you've been to. It's not old artifacts. The permanent exhibit is all interactive. It's not old artifacts. The changing exhibits they sometimes have, like, for example, the typewriters, the tools of the trade,
sure.
that's a temporary exhibit.
Right.
So get down there and see those typewriters. They will not always be there. This is a temporary exhibit.
Yeah.
But it's interactive. It's the experience, the way Christopher was describing the My America exhibit, that you feel like you're with the person and they're talking to you on this giant touchscreen. Like, that's a new way of having a museum reach out to you. And I think you have to be experienced to be understood what kind of museum it is.
What's smart about it is attuned to the interactive way in which young people especially interact.
Yeah, we know we have to compete with what they can take out of their pocket and look up on their phone. So we try to do things that are very creative and engaging and interesting and not overwhelming. So our space, you know, it's one floor of a office building, but we have over 3 novels worth of written material packed in there. But it's all done in such a easily digestible way that people can come in and spend, you know, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. We've had some people come back and spend the next half of the day there.
Oh, so, I don't doubt that.
So, yeah, it's really, it gives people a chance to kind of engage at the level they want to.
Well, what do you two do for Christmas?
As little as possible.
We will have Christmas with my my sisters and family who still live in the house I was born and baptized in. Well, not born there. I was born at Christ Hospital. But
wow.
So.
Wow. And you're from Colorado, right?
Yes, that's right. So we'll be doing Christmas here.
And then some of her family is going to be in for the kind of Christmas to New Year's time.
Yeah.
So. And the museum, I'm assuming, is closed Christmas Day and
closed Christmas
New Year's Day,
closed New Year's Day, but open all the other days around those.
I'm a big, big, big fan of Christmas traditions in Chicago, though they are shrinking. I don't, the bean is not one of my traditions. I'll take a look at the tree. I'll go to the Kindle Market until I fear of getting trampled on. I'll have a bratwurst. I will go to Marshall Fields, which is what I will always call Macy's.
Yeah,
no,
me too.
No offense to Macy's. No. You know, no.
They can't help it that they're not Marshall Fields.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is if Macy's hadn't bought it, God knows what would have happened to that building. That's my
very
other.
True.
And it was my father who wrote the history of Marshall Fields in 1950. To a book called Give the Lady What She Wants, which was one of the early
That was it.
I'm dying to know what your Christmas traditions are that you're really excited about.
American Writers Museum.
Yay.
I'm going to go in there and type. I know that is really one of my, I mean, I work within a couple blocks, so I wander over there and the nice kids say, oh, you don't have to pay, and I just go in and wander around. And I want to go up to Christopher's office all
type
by myself and get in stuff. It is a delight to see you again, Christopher, and it's a real treat to meet you, Stephanie. I'm going to go back to the office tomorrow and see if I wrote about you, but I'm also going to tell Howard Reich that he made one of the great matches, romantic matches, that I've encountered all of 2019. Again, ladies and gentlemen, AmericanWritersMuseum.org. The website will... intrigue and delight and entice you, and go there. 180 North Michigan. Make it one of your new Christmas holiday traditions, and you can go over to Miller's and have a hot toddy and get drunk. I don't think I'm on next Sunday. I think there's a game. Dan Long doesn't know. He's the engineer. Ro Coleman, we don't know. That's the way we run. That's the way we run. Thank you for producing, dear. Thank you for engineering. Have a nice week, everybody.